Next case on our calendar is 05702 and 05734. John Doe versus the Archdiocese of Cincinnati. Justice Resnick has recused herself from this case. We're very pleased to have sitting in place of Justice Resnick, Judge Beth Whitmore, sitting in the Judge of the Court of Appeals. We also have recusal from Justice Lanzinger, and we have sitting in place of Justice Lanzinger, Judge Judith French, also a Judge of the Court of Appeals. Mr. Vanderlaan.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I'm Mark Vanderlaan. With me today are my co-counsel from Dinsmore and Scholl, Mr. Kirk Wall, and Mr. Tim Mangan. Also with me at council table is David Young from Squire Sanders and Dempsey, who is here on behalf of the Amicus Catholic Conference of Ohio. Mr. Chief Justice, I would like to reserve 2 minutes of time, if I may. But this is the appeal of the Archdiocese of Cincinnati from the ruling of the Third District Court of Appeals. In addition, the Third District certified this as a conflict with the First District. I submit it's in conflict not only with the First District, the decision below was in conflict with virtually every other court of appeals that has looked at this issue since this court issued its opinion in Doe versus First United Methodist Church. Specifically, the First District examined this very recently in Kramer versus Archdiocese of Cincinnati, and then a number of cases that followed that. The Eighth District in Doe versus Catholic Diocese of Cleveland. The 12th District looked at this in the context of a public school setting in A&S versus Fairfield City Schools. In short, we submit that we are now before this court to try to put to rest the issue of how the statute of limitations is applied in a case involving childhood sexual abuse. And specifically in this particular instance, we're dealing with a situation where the secondary actor, if you will, in this case the Archdiocese of Cincinnati as opposed to the perpetrator, is at issue. I think it is imperative, if we look at this in the context of settled jurisprudence, to overlay the facts of Doe versus First United Methodists precisely with the facts in this case. They are remarkable in terms of their similarities, and remarkable likewise in, I think, the need to have uniformity in terms of application. Specifically, in both cases, abuse was alleged, which occurred in the mid-1980s. The plaintiffs in both instances, both here and in Doe versus First United Methodist, were at the time teenagers. In the original Doe case, the plaintiff turned 18 in the year 1984. Here, the plaintiff turned 18 in the year 1986. Both, as the complaint shows, were fully aware of the abuse at all times. Both knew the identity of the abuser. Both knew who was the employer of the abuser and the relationship in Doe 1, as we'll call it, with both the First United Methodist Church as well as the public school district. In this case, it was known that the alleged abuser was a priest of the Archdiocese. No one has repressed memory.
Counsel, the I think there is one legal difference in that I don't believe the Methodist case involved a claim under the pattern of corrupt activity statute, did it?
No, it did not. And that would be a second issue that I would address. But if we look at it from all the various common law allegations, I submit that they're included.
In terms of the underlying fact pattern?
Yes.
Yeah. But here the plaintiff attempts to bring a cause of action under another statute that was not present in the Methodist case.
No, but in this case, I think this is significant. In this case, the conduct in question all occurred sometime allegedly between, I believe, the years 1981 and 84. Ohio's Corrupt Practices Act did not come into existence until January 1st of 1986. The issue then is, well, when does the cause of action arise? If you were looking at it from a, right, what I would call a RICO, if you're looking at it from the federal perspective, or POCA or OPCA under the Ohio perspective. The guidance that we have here is again, remarkable in terms of what's afforded. First, I would submit that an attempt to apply that standard to this case is, frankly, an unconstitutional retroactive application of a statute.
I understand that with respect, in some respects, but if I assume what they're trying to get at is the cover-up continued after the statute was enacted.
Well, let's examine that.
Okay.
Because the issue is that the plaintiff in this case makes no allegation of having any contact whatsoever with the Archdiocese with regard to any potential claim that he had from the time that it happened until he filed his lawsuit in 2004. So looking at it from the Ohio common law perspective, if you will, the difference between this and Doe 1 is that this plaintiff waited 13 additional years before he filed a lawsuit as compared to Doe 1. With respect to looking at it from the within the context of the organized crime issue, when does the statute start to run? And again, if we look at the unanimous opinion of the United States Supreme Court in Rotella versus Wood, it is very instructive. It's instructive in that the United States Supreme Court actually had a unanimous decision. But beyond that, it was a question there in terms of RICO. When does the cause of action arise? In other words, when do we start running the statute of limitations? In Rotella, the situation involved a case where an individual was institutionalized in a mental institution. There was some scandal involving the mental institution, and he determined that he had been kept there against his will for a prolonged period of time. And the issue there was, when does the statute start to run? He discovered this years later, long after the RICO statute would have run, and advocated a discovery rule sort of concept. A unanimous Supreme Court, in an opinion authored by Justice Souter, said, look, RICO, and I submit in this case, POCA, is complex enough as it is. The pleading requirements, the issue of enterprise, the issue of related acts or unrelated acts is all complex enough. Let's not try to do something that makes the application of the statute of limitations a basically unworkable act. So the Supreme Court of the United States says, look, this person was institutionalized. He was aware of that. He was let out later than he thought he should have been. He knew that at the very time that occurred. His time commenced running then and there. It was not because he read something in a newspaper at some later time. It was not because somebody else had made a complaint about a similar circumstance years later. It was focused on the plaintiff's own individual circumstance.
Counsel, how do you reconcile that with the statutory language in Ohio that speaks to the statute of limitations beginning to run from when the conduct terminates? And where we've got a pleading that says this conduct continued until 2002, how can you not go by the statutory statute of limitations?
Well, the question is the conduct, and the question is the injurious conduct. The injurious conduct in this case is, in fact, the abuse which occurred. That is the injury. And whether we look at the way this court looked at it in Doe versus First United Methodist, whether you look at it the way the U.S. Supreme Court looked at it in Rotella versus Wood, the injury, the real injury here is just that. If, in fact, the argument is, you didn't tell me that I had a claim in 1986 when I turned 18, whether the Archdiocese was aware of that or not, what that concept and what has been advocated by the other side would amount to is a situation where a plaintiff subjectively determines when and if he's going to commence an action. And in this case, whether it's an action for various common law torts or whether it's an action under a difficult, if you will, statutory scheme, where there has to be some definition about when it begins, I think the guidance that we have from both this court in other contexts, admittedly, and in Rotella versus Wood is that you cannot simply say, well, there's other conduct, and when they talk about concealment, if concealment is equated with silence, then the statute never runs. And
counsel,
I believe that's what's been advocated.
Yeah, counsel.
The statute never runs.
Counsel, we're dealing with the pleading, so we're limited in what we know.
Sure.
At this point. I think the read, and your argument is it's a mighty thin read, in terms of the pleadings, is that the pattern of corrupt activity or the RICO violation in failing to disclose and continuing to cover up was causing an ongoing harm that this individual was continuing to suffer damage that could have been stopped. So I think at least what
I'm not sure
how they're trying to keep this alive from a statute standpoint is to say I was continuing to suffer harm that could have been stopped. But for the continuation of the cover-up.
Again, equating cover-up with silence.
That yes.
would be the situation in virtually any injury type of case, particularly if it has a sequela that goes on into the future. That type of rationale seems to drive, a stake in the heart of the whole notion of statutes of limitations in even more garden variety types of situations. And this court has not recognized that. The Supreme Court of the United States certainly hasn't. There have been rare instances here where the court has fashioned or crafted a discovery rule. But in this type of setting, in this specific type of setting, and again, we come back to Doe versus First United Methodist, it expressly chose not to do so. Now, it's not as though it wasn't in the minds of this court at the time. The court had decided only 6 months earlier, Browning versus Burt, where this court did craft a discovery rule of sorts.
And again, I want to focus on the corrupt activities charge. To even have that charge is... Does it require that there has to be an affirmative duty to disclose? You characterize it as silence, and I characterize it with a more pejorative term. But silence, as you characterize it,
well, it has to
isn't generally against the law. But here there are some affirmative duties. Are there not in other statutes to disclose this kind of activity?
Yeah, but
to public authorities if it is known.
If it's known.
Yes.
But that's not sufficient under our POCA statute.
To get
You're talking about certain specified felonies that are required for that. It is not just a breach of law, a misdemeanor here, a misdemeanor there. And by the way, those are not ongoing offenses. Constitute something that fits the statutory definitions under POCA.
So what I'm trying to probe is, irregardless of statute of limitations, you would argue there isn't even a violation.
That's true. I would argue that. I would also argue, too, I mean, we see this very same type of allegation pattern made in the context of a POCA case coming out of the 8th District in the Herakovich case, which we've submitted to the court as supplemental authority, where the 8th District, Cuyahoga County, threw that out as well because of, frankly, the inability to plead anything which meets the statutory definitions. I submit we have the same circumstance here. We couldn't brief it that fully because Herakovich came out after we briefed it, but it is mentioned in our briefing as well. One doesn't just throw up against the wall allegations of alleged misconduct and say, well, we have a lot here, so therefore there's a pattern of corrupt practices. That doesn't fit under our statutory definitions. And I realize this court has not dealt with POCA much, if at all, but I think particularly the 8th District, and as well as the 1st District in a couple key cases they have, and at least the cases from the 1st District were cited by the 1st District in cases that have thrown out these allegations that are identically made in cases that were before the 1st District.
Thank you, Mr. Vanderlaan.
Thank you.
Mr. Kircher.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The court is probably wrestling with the dilemma of how to permit worthy plaintiffs to bring worthy causes of action without completely undermining the rationale supporting statute of limitations jurisprudence. And I would submit in this case, on these facts, the answer is not very difficult. We're not asking the court to create law. We're not asking the court to legislate from the bench. We're merely asking the court to apply its own precedents. We're not talking about tire blowout cases or supermarket assault cases, as the appellants have analogized in their briefs. Appellants make it sound so easy that a victim, once they turn 18, simply goes to a lawyer, hires a lawyer, the lawyer files suit, they do discovery, they uncover the concealment. We're talking about cases where children have been raped by authority figures, and their rapes have been enabled by an entity with a fiduciary duty to these children. These children can barely function when they're 18 years old. They suffer from shame, humiliation, guilt, depression, substance abuse. To put a burden on them that they, black and white law, as a matter of law, must go to a lawyer and file suit before 20 is a harsh result that they don't deserve.
Counsel, is that not a statutory remedy that you're seeking, something that the General Assembly should address?
Your Honor,
carving out an exception for victims of sexual abuse, no matter who the perpetrator?
Your Honor, this court has carved out exceptions for different classes of plaintiffs, medical malpractice plaintiffs, legal malpractice plaintiffs, DES victims. They have all been permitted to apply the discovery rule. And yes, even childhood sexual abuse victims in the Ault versus Jasko case, in a repressed memory context, have been permitted to use discovery rule. All we're asking is that this class of plaintiffs be permitted to use that same discovery rule. In fact, this court has a deep respect for stare decisis. I would argue that if this court declined to apply the discovery rule, it would be deviating from Browning versus Burt, Doe versus First United Methodist Church, Ault versus Jasko, Collins versus Sotka, and Norgard versus Brush Wellman, all of which applied and even expanded the discovery rule. And let me address those cases for a moment. Browning versus Burt simply declared that there can be separate triggering events for statutes of limitations. In that case, there was one statute of limitation that started a certain time against the physician, and then the statute of limitations against the hospital started a separate time because the plaintiffs did not have the knowledge to bring a claim against the hospital in that case. 9 months later, this court decided Doe versus First United Methodist Church. That case cites Browning favorably. and declined to apply a discovery rule only because the plaintiff in that case did not allege that there was insufficient information against the church. And in fact, the court specifically said, we are only left to assume on the facts of this case that the events triggering the statute of limitations must be the same. Well, I submit to you, we have made the claim in this case that there are separate triggering events. And these were 12B dismissals, or this case is 12B dismissal. We've made a sufficient allegation. Now we should be permitted to go into discovery. Ault versus Jasco, only 5 months after Doe versus First United Methodist Church, then did apply the discovery rule in a childhood sexual abuse case. And the only reason they didn't consider a claim against an entity was because that was a simple case of a daughter against her father. There was no enabler. There was no other defendant other than the father.
Wasn't the respondeat superior theory viable at the time you filed initially?
In our case, Your Honor?
Yes.
Respondeat superior is troublesome because of First Amendment issues with regard to religious institution. That is not our primary claim.
Could you not have pursued the discovery, though, in that case?
In our case that
yes.
we filed? In other words, file against the perpetrator first, pursue discovery?
Multiple defendants.
I don't know how that gets us past where we are now. I think that the trial court would have dismissed anyway. Am I understanding your question, Your Honor?
I'm wondering why you couldn't have sued the Archdiocese in the first case.
There was not a first case. Isn't that, I had the same question. The plaintiff did not sue the priest within the one-year statute of limitations and then filed a second case here. Is that correct?
That's correct,
Your
Honor.
One case.
There's only one case.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Collins versus Sotka and then Norgaard both cited Browning favorably. So only 4 years ago in the Norgaard case, this court cited Browning and Collins favorably and expanded the discovery rule even further. The appellant suggests that, well, even if the discovery rule is available to the plaintiff in this case, it doesn't help the plaintiff because the statute of limitation starts when the injury occurred. Well, that's not what Norgaard, Collins, Browning say. The distinction is that those cases say that the statute of limitations against the enabler begins to run when the wrongful conduct of that particular defendant is discovered, not when the injury is discovered.
Or, counsel, when the victim might have had enough information to investigate to determine whether there was wrongful conduct. So why, in this case, was there not enough information at the time that the victim reached majority for him to discover either respondeat superior or fiduciary duty claims? If he knew this was a priest, he knew this priest reported to the Archdiocese, why isn't that enough for him to at least investigate?
Because his environment said otherwise, and this relates back to Justice Pfeiffer's question to appellant's counsel. What the victim in this case saw was the church continuing to hold out Father Hopp as a chaste, pure individual, a representative of Christ on earth. It wasn't merely silence. It was affirmative representations that this priest is a pastor, and we're going to keep him here for 3 years. We're going to put him in another church, and we're going to place him as a pastor, as the leader of the flock. This individual thought he was the only one, and as the amicus has presented to this court, childhood sexual abuse victims go through the situation of, what did I do to make this holy man do such a terrible thing to me? What is there different about me? And they go through the guilt and the shame, and they can't comprehend that this person may have had other victims when the church is saying we're protecting children.
But that's obviously a very persuasive argument, but is that not precisely the argument that's being made now in the General Assembly? The point being that that's the place for that policy decision to be made. Otherwise, we have to look at each plaintiff. The system has to look at each plaintiff to decide, well, what's this person's level of knowledge to know to file something within the, or at least go to a lawyer to file something within the statute of limitation. That would be a departure, would it not, from our jurisprudence?
I think it's the other way, Your Honor. And I'm very aware that Chief Justice has written some very eloquent and well-reasoned dissents in the cases that I've cited. And
they weren't persuasive, though, in those cases. They weren't eloquent enough.
Well, and Your Honor's main point was that this belongs in the legislature. But I would argue at this point, in 2006, Your Honor has always had a deep respect for stare decisis. And the precedents are Browning through Norgaard. And if the court now were to deny the discovery rule to these victims, that would be a departure. That would be a departure from stare decisis. Because, Your Honor, there's no logical reason why this class of plaintiffs should be denied the discovery rule that's permitted to medical malpractice victims, legal malpractice victims, DES victims.
But those discovery rules are really more dependent on external factors that were not available. The discovery rule you seem to be asking us to adopt is because the victim of a sexual abuse, and this could happen to, a step-parent, a father abuser. I mean, this can happen to anybody, so the rule you want us to write seems to have much broader implication than just the clergy, that a victim of sexual abuse goes through such trauma emotionally, they just really can't deal with even trying to discover. And so it's really a discovery rule that depends more on their mental state, it seems, than the facts that exist. In these other cases we had, there were facts that didn't come to light. Here, it's really the emotional state of the victim that's preventing the investigation of the facts. I mean, somebody started the first case to find out about the alleged cover-ups, and so somebody dealt with their emotional issues, and yours seem to be tied to the emotional state of a victim not able to deal with discovering what is actually already there to discover.
Thank you, Your Honor. I guess I've got three things to say on that question. Number one, this court previously has recognized the difficulty that childhood sexual abuse victims have in the Ault case, in the Hensley case.
That was repressed memory, again, wasn't?
Repressed memory was the holding, but in getting there, it recognized the difficulties that childhood sexual abuse victims have psychologically. Second issue is that this court cannot ignore the context of where we are in 2006. 4 years ago, there were shocking revelations that caught the nation's attention. Prior to the Boston Globe series in January of 2002, most Catholics never would have even imagined that the Catholic Church was harboring pedophiles and enabling their repeated abuse. They couldn't even comprehend that prior to then. And events are still unfolding in the past 4 years, which have been shocking. But that leads into the equitable estoppel argument, which we have submitted as an alternative. And the basis of that is fundamental fairness. If a defendant with a fiduciary duty to disclose information conceals that information and prevents a plaintiff from bringing a claim, then that defendant should not be permitted to raise the statute of limitations argument. That is equitable estoppel, which has precedent in Ohio courts. And this court in the Ryan, State ex rel Ryan case said—
Counsel, based on that last point that you made, how did the Archdiocese prevent your client from bringing forward an action?
Again, by representing in his environment that there was, let me distinguish. He knew that Father Hopp had abused him. He never had any clue, no reason to believe, that the church knew of prior violations by Hopp, or even knew of later violations and failed then to notify him to help his healing.
Did the church know of his existence?
Know of my client's existence? We haven't gotten into discovery, Your Honor. This is a 12B6 dismissal, so I can't answer that question. We would like to discover that issue.
Well, I guess the answer is, did your client tell the church?
No, my client did not come forward. However, there are so many red flags in Father Hopp's background that it raises a question whether they knew about him. And let me mention that there are a handful of cases that have been permitted to go forward. Greene County, Dark County, Montgomery County. In those cases, I do have discovery. And in fact, one of those cases is against Father Hopp in Dark County. And I've seen his file. I'm under a protective order that was requested by the Archdiocese. I can't reveal the facts. But I am excited about what that says for this case.
Counsel, on a purely, let's get back to the procedure for a moment. You're thrown out on a 12B6. The Court of Appeals says that both sides agree this court's pronouncement in the Doe case is really controlling, and they look at the Doe case and conclude, in sum, we conclude that the appellant in this case has made the specific allegation, the absence of which was determinative in Doe, to wit, insufficiency of knowledge regarding the negligence of the Archdiocese until April of 2002. And that's what their decision turned on, as I understand it, that you have alleged something that was not alleged in Doe. If you prevail, if we agree with the Court of Appeals, you could still lose long before going to trial, could you not? In other words, you get through discovery, and they're able to show that your client didn't have this repressed memory problem or the things that caused them to conclude, or your allegation that until April of 2002, he couldn't bring the action. And they can establish that.
Correct, Your Honor. We're subject to a Rule 56 summary judgment motion before we ever see a jury. The plaintiff still has to prove the case. If you send this back, if you affirm and send this back, we still have to prove our case, and we're still subject to Rule 56 summary judgment.
Mr. Kircher, could I direct your attention to the RICO situation?
Please.
That's here. If I understand it correctly, the argument is that you're making a claim on a statute that didn't exist at the time of this alleged abuse.
Correct.
I just wonder if you would address that.
Thank you, Your Honor. Our allegation is not that the church physically abused my client. Our allegation is that the church concealed it, continued to represent that this was a chaste individual so that my client couldn't bring his claim. That's the pattern of corrupt activity. And the appellants have failed to mention the Clare case, the U.S. Supreme Court case, which explicitly says that equitable estoppel is a tolling provision for civil RICO cases. They want to talk about Rotella, 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 but Clare was not disturbed by Rotella. Rotella explicitly said we are not disturbing equitable estoppel on civil RICO claims. So at least on that point, I think this court has to affirm the third district.
And there can be a retroactive application of that? Is that your view? Because that statute didn't come into existence until a couple years beyond the date of the alleged abuse.
But the conduct of the archdiocese and the archbishop continued on. It was present every time they moved Hop and represented him to be a person of chaste background. Okay. So that the background, I think. Thank you. I ask that the court affirm the third district.
Thank you, Mr. Kircher. Mr. Vanderlaan, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
I think we've adequately addressed in our briefing why equitable estoppel simply doesn't apply here. There has been no misrepresentation made to this plaintiff at any time. The only allegation here is that something happened to him and he didn't come forward until 2004. That is the allegation in the complaint. That's what the court had to deal with, as did the Court of Appeals in the First District, in the Eighth District, the 12th District, in similarly pled things. I would only submit that Doe versus First United Methodist, page 538, explains very conclusively why this is a case that is on all fours with that result. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal, please adjourn court.
All rise.